This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Damnation, Retribution and Redemption, Hell Plains and Purgatory in speculative fiction.
Now, I'm curious as to why, Jules, you suggested this episode.
I think it's one that's sort of been percolating away for a little while. There's this quite... It's an odd state of mind when you think about it, because if you say hell to somebody, generally, unless they come from a religious background which has a very different concept of hell, the idea is eternal punishment.
Yeah.
And what I'm curious about really is why we have this desire, generally, to see people continually punished after death.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And also, a lot of that comes from influences from the Abrahamic religions, particularly Christianity, and generally the word hell doesn't actually mean that at all. It comes from much, much older sources. It comes from even older sources than the old Nordic and High Germanic ones. So,
yeah.
Hell originated from the Proto-Germanic word halja, mm-hmm. Which was commuted to helja in Old Saxon or Old English.
Mm-hmm.
And you can trace it to the Gothic, Helja, again. There's various permutations, and it all comes from this one word. And that word actually means to hide or conceal. There's nothing about punishment or retribution. So when people were originally talking about hell as a physical plane, what they were talking about is the place where people go once they're dead, because you can't see them anymore. They're hidden. They're concealed from you. It's a hidden place. You don't know what happens after death. It's the biggest I don't know, essentially.
Right.
And then, obviously, you had the Nordic myths of the goddess Hel, who was the daughter of Loki,
mm-hmm.
who became ruler of the land of the dead, which sounded awful. And I think the reason it sounded awful was because it had to be awful in comparison to Valhalla. You know, it had to be like a prize bee for those who didn't make it to Valhalla by dying gloriously in battle.
Yeah.
And it just sort of went from there. And when it mixed with other religions, particularly during the medieval era, hell came to mean, you know, a place. And you had things like the Inquisition advancing Christianity with fire and sword, and suggesting that people would burn for all eternity, that hell was a place of torture.
Yeah.
Even in early Gnostic Christianity, that wasn't what the concept of hell really was. It was a tragic concept. It was the idea that you will live without the sight of God. You will never know the Enlightenment. You'll never really know yourself.
Yeah.
And it was more to be pitied than anything else. It wasn't a punishment. It was a case of that's something you might bring on yourself if you don't open your mind a bit. So I find it quite ironic that hell then came to be known as this place of eternal damnation and punishment. But yeah. It's rich fodder in speculative fiction, so...
I think the whole thing with hell is that... no doubt it was about fear, and it was about instilling fear. And when it came to Hela, Loki's daughter and the sort of the Norse mythology, the whole idea of that wasn't fear necessarily of hell, but was fear of not achieving Valhalla.
Yeah.
So it was about reaching forward. It was about dying honorably. It was about not being afraid. And then with the Inquisition and around the time that hell really came to mean this sort of fiery burning damnation and all the images of demons torturing people appeared, was around the time that was happening in people's day-to-day lives. They were witnessing it. They were witnessing executions. They were witnessing people being burned at the stake, hung, drawn, and quartered. They saw this pain. It was a very real part of their existence. And they were afraid of it, rightfully so. We all are, you know, they were grossly fascinated by it. They sort of liked seeing other people go through that in some ways, people they perceived to be their enemies. But they, you know, they were afraid of it happening to themselves. So it was a perfect tool of fear to say, this thing, if you are bad, but you are clever and you think you've gotten away with it and you'll never be caught, the fact of the matter is that you will always be caught. This will always be your fate, whether it happens on Earth or afterwards. Not even death will let you escape that.
And the other prong of that fork, obviously, is the fact that, okay, you may get away with it on Earth, but God mm-hmm. sees it all. But on
yeah.
the other hand, if you repent on your deathbed, sincerely,
mm-hmm.
then you can avoid hell, basically. And when you think of, say, the 9th and 10th centuries, when you had summoners and pardoners who would actually sell pardons
mm-hmm.
to people so that they could avoid hell, you know, it became quite a nice little earner on the side as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, it certainly did. Yes. I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the depiction of hell was very much to aid the church and monarchy.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, there are things like The Divine Comedy by Dante, who, as fascinating as that book is, it was sort of takes this sort of gleeful delight describing the different planes of hell, the different types of sins, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really, in this beautiful Florentine language. And it's not really based on any real mythology as such. I mean, there's little bits taken from everywhere, and it was, you know, during the beginning of the Renaissance, so you had all these ideas filtering through, but there's bits taken from Greek myth, there's bits taken from Persian myth.
Yeah.
So it's another one of those things where, weirdly, the word has been permutated, and it just goes to show that just a word can have so much power.
Mm-hmm.
So it is actually, when people start arguing about definitions of words, sometimes it is really important, because 2,000 years later you might be arguing about whether it means eternal damnation or whether it means, you know what, you've actually made your life really difficult for yourself by refusing to embrace the fact that there's change,
mm-hmm.
which couldn't really be much more on the opposite end of the scale.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd agree with you. It's a fascinating concept, if you think about it. And its growth and its change and its development really, really does give an undercurrent of this ever prevalent mystery about death and about morality, whilst also being something which has then been controlled by external forces. I mean, it's, hell is such a huge concept, and I find it mind-boggling how something that was so internal and was really about the struggle, the personal struggle of coming to terms with the idea of not knowing what happens next, and how it became this almost a figure. Hell is almost a person, if that makes sense. It's so vivid in our minds, in one way or another, that it can genuinely strike fear into the hearts of people. It's just so real. And why that is, and probably the reason it's so real, and probably the reason that it was so easy to sell, was because that question has never left us, that question of what happens afterwards. And also the fact that for the most part we feel guilt, you know, when we've done something, and if we get away with something, we sometimes have the urge to confess. You know, that's what confessionals were all about, you know, the chance to sort of unload yourself, because we don't really like, you know, feeling guilty in silence. We just don't. We like to try and make things right, even at the cost of something else. So doing something that is perceived as bad and then being told that there is a hell, it's so easy to understand why it could be sold to the masses.
Yeah, I mean, I think another reason is if someone does you ill, if someone does wrong to you,
yeah,
and you've got no way of, if you've got no way of exacting retribution, mm-hmm. then the idea that God sees all and they will be punished is quite an attractive one.
Yes.
And I've been having a discussion with some people from the Stephen King Constant Reader fan club today. Not deliberately. I mean, I didn't think, oh, we're doing this podcast today, I think I'll go and pick a fight with someone with their religious beliefs. It just happened. But obviously Charles Manson died. And someone put up a picture and said, burn in hell. Which, you know, in no equivocal terms there.
Yeah.
That's what they think. And my question was, does anybody really deserve to burn or be tortured for all eternity? No matter what they've done. Surely after they've died, that's it. Whether you believe there's a hell, whether you believe there's heaven, whether you believe there's anything at all, surely after they've died, the amount of harm they can then do is so limited, it's limited only to what harm you continue to perpetuate yourself at that point. And I know most people don't want to hear that. Particularly if you've survived great ill from somebody else, and it doesn't have to be one of the Mansons, it can be anything. Mm-hmm. But there comes a point where you're not the victim anymore, you're not being tormented, you are continuing the harm that was already done to you, and it's quite hard to then turn around and say, I'm going to stop the cycle. But ultimately, if you do that, you're probably a happier, healthier, more productive person. I'm not saying this is what people should do, I'm just saying this is my perspective on it. So this is entirely opinion, and everyone's entitled to their own. But the knee-jerk, vociferous reactions of, you don't know what you're talking about, that I got facts after suggesting, you know, perhaps no one could do anything that is good enough, that is bad enough to result in being burned for all eternity.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but I feel that those people perhaps don't have a concept of what eternity actually is. Because are you seriously telling me that, okay, you kill 9 people, for example, or you're responsible for their deaths, and yeah, but there's some pretty squicky circumstances in Charles Manson's case. Are you seriously telling me that, okay, he deserves to be burned for all eternity for that? Because eternity? I mean, this is the bit I'm trying to underline here. Eternity. Seriously.
Yeah.
This is not a punishment fitting the crime type situation. I'm not saying people shouldn't be held accountable for their actions. They absolutely should. But once they're dead, let's draw a line under it, is my opinion.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting from my perspective to see how many people kept coming back and saying, oh no, they haven't paid enough yet.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't think I'm necessarily someone who believes, I mean, I do believe in redemption. I believe everyone should have the opportunity for redemption. I just don't necessarily think that I should be the person who gives it to them. I've known some real shit in my life. But, you know, that's not up to me. The entire world is not ordered to my liking. It's not under my control. I don't, you know, I don't have to forgive or forget or anything. But on the other hand, I don't have to think about them either. They can cease to exist as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So why do some people have this huge investment in being comforted by the idea of someone being tortured for all eternity? And I genuinely cannot wrap my head around that.
I think it's really to do with the fact, it's to do with powerlessness and the fact that if you're hurting, if you've been hurt by something, even if you've only just been hurt by knowing that something bad has been committed, you know, that can still be, you know, a reaction. And if you feel like there's something that should have been done, which wasn't, and you feel like that the amount of pain that was created just hasn't been paid back, I can understand why people need to have the sense that actually that someone didn't get off, you know.
I can totally understand that, but once decades have passed and you're literally looking at it cold-bloodedly.
Mm-hmm.
And people are still clinging to this, you know, with two hands, like the hands of death. That doesn't make sense to me. I mean, the initial anger and pain and everything, it's a way of processing it. Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think after that, you have to start putting some effort into to hold on to it that tightly. And what you're actually putting effort into doing is not in getting retribution or atonement, or even punishment for the person who wronged you. What you're actually doing is making sure that you don't developmentally change. You stay that person. You stay the person who was done to. And the sad thing about that is if you stay the person who was done to, you start becoming a person who is doing to others without probably even realising it.
I just don't think there's any easy answer to that.
No, there really isn't. I mean, unfortunately, this is an open-ended fence-sitting question where I don't have the answers, and I'm actually quite comfortable not having the answers.
Yeah.
But there are some things I just like, okay, I genuinely don't understand why you've got that much investment in this. And it's certainly in the Charles Manson sense of the word, all the people who I've been speaking to, they can't all have been victims of Charles Manson. It's just physically not possible.
Yeah.
They can't even know someone who was. So at that point, it's a case of you're kind of doing a Twitter shaming at that point, where you're just jumping onto a case because maybe you feel bad about something else, or maybe you need to feel bad about something.
Yeah.
And that sort of mindset's quite dangerous, because that's the sort of de-individuation that ironically allowed things like the Spanish Inquisition to happen in the first place.
Yeah. It's a hard one. It's a hard one. But I think for the most part, the sort of the burn in hell, it is a comforter. And that's what it's designed to be. And so I can't sort of say people shouldn't say that, because I'm just as guilty of it. I'm guilty of sort of thinking of certain people and just thinking they really do deserve to be punished. More than they were, that they got away with it to a certain degree. And it's also like, you know, if something bad it happens to you from something nameless, like your bicycle gets stolen or someone, you know, pushes you over and then runs off, and you just sit there and you just want all the awful things in the world to happen, and you sit there and you hope that something bad happens to them. It's harmless in a lot of ways, but I can totally see where you come from, where if that mentality is allowed to fester, it can mean that we are desensitized to acts of violence, which we shouldn't be. We should never be desensitized to acts of violence, okay? And I think it's totally one thing to imagine sort of beating someone to a pulp and then actually having the ability to beat someone to a pulp, or to imagine, say, oh, I'd love to see him burn on the stake, and then to actually see that. And it's the important thing of being able to understand that the fury that you feel internally and that anger, that's just you dealing with it in one particular way. But if it, you're right, if I think if you hold on to it and you continue to allow that, you know, it becomes a problem when you're able to cross the line between really feeling something and sort of taking things into your own hands and being desensitized to what you're feeling.
Yeah. And I suppose the thing is now, okay, a slight tangent, but talking about, say, Twitter shaming, someone says something that really offends you, or rather, you hear it and it really offends you, but perhaps you didn't hear what you thought you heard.
Yeah.
Perhaps to you, that's what it sounded like. Perhaps what they're saying was something completely different. You heard it out of context. So let's say this happened at a conference, and it happens at an unfortunate moment. Someone makes an off-colour joke to someone right behind you, and you're offended because you're one sort of person and they're another sort of person. And they're not talking about you at all. They're not even talking about the conference. It's just a couple of people mucking around being a bit childish.
Yeah.
So what you do is you snap a picture of them, put it up on Twitter and say, I've just seen these two goons doing such and such. And then everybody piles on. And then it's like a public execution, or it may as well be.
Yeah.
Because what happens then is their company hears about it, recognises the employees, sacks them, they're sent home to their families. Perhaps they have three children that they're supposed to be supporting. And that's what I mean. And it's this sort of, burn in hell for all eternity, you scumbag mentality. But okay, if that's just you saying that, it's not that it's okay, but I can kind of see your point, and you have the right to your opinion, and I have the right to question it. But if you get to the point where you just do this one little thing, and it's not a case of you're not saying it to yourself anymore, you're saying it to, I don't know, 200 people on Twitter who will tweet it to 200 people, and so on and so forth, and you get this avalanche effect, then that's already become an action, and you don't think you've really done anything.
Yeah.
It's the gap between thoughts and words and action are so slender now. Unbelievably so.
And it's also, it's not, it's, Yeah, that there are, there's this element of consequence that one has to consider. And it's the fact that, yeah, online and stuff like that, because of the sort of the mentality, and because of the strong feelings that we have, we can see what we want to see. So you should post up that picture. It's like, this man just said this. And then everyone sort of says, oh, he's the monster. He's, and it's done without context. I mean, how do we even know that that man did say anything like that?
Well, that's the thing, isn't
we
it?
We don't.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to go off on a bit of a tangent there, because obviously we are talking about hell planes, but it's an interesting look at from, you can go from Halya, from the Proto-Germanic, to hell, and the two things mean completely the opposite thing. And in the same respect, you can have someone saying, you know, burn in hell for all eternity to themselves, and then if they posted something about someone else on Twitter, then you could absolutely ruin their lives for a time. So it's this idea of, yes, we all want justice, or what we perceive as justice, and perhaps we want punishment more than we want atonement. And we're all probably guilty of that on occasion. Not to get all Dostoevsky on you, but at what point does the punishment stop fitting the crime? And the idea that you're creating these entire planes of reality where vast swathes of people who, I mean, according to certain religions, if I don't believe in them, absolutely, and follow their ways, if I don't act like a woman should in those religions, I deserve to burn for all eternity. So, you know, it's, what do you consider a crime?
Yeah.
If being self-directing and speaking out and talking to you now on a podcast that other people can listen to means that I burn in hell, then I absolutely reject that religion. So.
Yeah. Yeah. We'd both be in big trouble. So, yeah, we'd probably, I mean, according to lots of religions, we'd be burning in hell right now.
Yeah.
It's always the burning, isn't it? The burning in hell.
Yeah, I mean, some of them it's just an eternal torment. I mean, some things get quite creative with the sorts of torture you would experience in hell. They're always, what I notice is they're nearly always very physical tortures.
And yeah.
As horrible as that is, there must come a point where, you know how you watch a horror movie and if you watch it 50 times, it's not scary anymore?
Yeah.
As bad as it is, you know, a lot of the time when you're made physically helpless, after a certain amount of time, it's endurable because it's happened before. It's happened enough times before, and that's awful. But at the same time, that's nowhere near as bad as a constant change of mental torment, I think.
Yeah. It is interesting because we go to sort of Hades, where they did have those physical punishments.
Yeah.
You know, such as rolling a boulder up a hill and stuff like that. Which was interesting, and I sort of liked it in a different way on account of the fact that it's hell in the sense that no matter how many times they do it, they always feel like there is an actual chance that it'll end this time. There's almost the possibility that it could end.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about some speculative fiction, and I'm going to talk about two shows. Which may even be linked, and they may even be in the same universe, I don't even know. But both are based on comics, so I'm going to talk about Lucifer, and I'm going to talk about the Preacher.
I was going to say that Preacher, yeah.
Yeah, so in Preacher, the hellscape is basically you are reliving your worst memory, and it's the same thing in Lucifer. You're constantly reliving your worst memory over and over and over and over again. Now, particularly they say in Lucifer, in the most recent episode, there was this revelation where Lucifer basically said that he isn't even the one who chooses who goes to hell or not. It's people do it to themselves. Their own guilt drives them downward. Their own guilt drives them down. And the worst thing is that actually the doors to hell aren't locked behind them. They can actually leave and go to heaven at any time. The thing that locks them down there is their guilt.
Yeah.
And if they overcome their guilt, and if they overcome what they've done, sort of step out of the spiral, they will get out. But ultimately, no one has ever managed to do it. So I really, really liked that, where it was literally just they'd reset. And that's what the torment was that it would just happen over and over and over again. And they just think, in some cases, I think their minds sort of immediately went back to the start. But the whole thing was that they would always be stuck in the same cycle because that was their human nature and they just couldn't stop it.
Yeah.
And it seems to be the same in Preacher. There's this detail thing about with the cowboy.
Yeah, see, that was quite interesting because the full-on physical hell thing is that, as you say, you live over your worst moment over and over again. There's various other bits of torture and things going on, but it is very much mental torture.
Yeah.
And the character who gets sent there largely by accident because the preacher has absorbed the voice of Metatron, the voice of God. So when he gives a command, you have to obey him. And he gets annoyed with his kid and tells him to go to hell. So the kid goes to hell.
Yeah.
He's actually not a bad kid, but he did attempt to kill himself, and he came from a Catholic, not Catholic, he came from a religious background where basically, I mean, in Catholicism, attempting to kill yourself is a mortal sin and immediately damns you to hell.
He did also shoot a woman.
No, he didn't. She shot herself.
Did she? I haven't seen season two.
No, it was a suicide pact. I've read the graphic novels as well. It was a suicide pact. He tried to stop her. Then basically what happened was she said, oh, okay. And she was basically a very selfish, spoiled little girl. And it was kind of she was just doing it unthinkingly. And he stopped her and he really has a crush on her. But she was going to do it because her boyfriend was cheating on her with someone she didn't think was worthy.
Right.
So he stops her killing herself with a double barrel shotgun, which is, you know, a stupid way to try and kill yourself anyway. It'll work, but, you know, it's not a prime method, in my opinion. he kisses her in that moment, and that was his big mistake, the fact that he just kisses her after he's talked her out of it. And she's so disgusted, she shoots herself. And he panics and shoots himself as well, but he kind of gets it wrong. She's actually not dead.
Yeah.
She's in a vegetative state because he manages to knock the gun aside at the last minute. He, however, needs a full facial reconstruction, which is why he ends up being, you know, called basically arsehole face because that's what's happened to his mouth.
Yeah.
But that's what he's reliving over and over and over and over again, which is pretty horrible, obviously.
Hmm.
I think that bit in when we're doing those hell scenes in Preacher, the interesting fact is what that shows us is that somebody who's sent to prison on a minor charge can actually become genuinely a very bad person because they've had to survive. And that's what's happening with that character journey. And it's very interesting to take that and say, well, you know, this is kind of what's happened in hell as well, because hell is the ultimate penal colony.
Yeah. That is an interesting thing. And I think that's sort of where Lucifer and Preacher sort of divert onto different roads. Because Preacher is quite anti-heroic.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that any of them are good guys.
Nope, not at all.
Yeah, my favourite character is by far the vampire.
Yeah, he's brilliant. The only reason I will watch it, basically, because the rest of it, I'm not terribly interested in it, but I really love his character arc.
Yeah. So, in that case, it's about the fact that there is no infallibility. So things make mistakes. So you've got someone who's in hell who's becoming more monstrous as time goes on. Rather than becoming, you know, one assumes that the innocents would be able to get out. Not that it would turn them worse. It would be guilty people get worse. And in turning him worse, he's therefore sort of getting a little bit more powerful, if that makes sense. But in Lucifer, it's not quite like that. And whilst, you know, obviously Lucifer is almost constantly questioning God's fallibility and stuff like that, and his constant internal conflict is between him and his relationship with his father. But there is this sense that innocent people don't go to hell.
Yeah.
But I the thing is, I find a flaw in that, in that you go to hell if you feel guilty. So what happens to the people who don't feel guilty?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because there are people who just genuinely have no connection with that at all. And they're happy to do whatever they want. So presumably they go to heaven.
Yeah. Or it might even be the guilt. It might just be the recognition that you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
The recognition that something has happened. And they haven't addressed that yet. And I'll be curious to see whether they do address that and how that sort of works. Because then also the question is whether you have actually done something bad. Whether you just feel guilty for something, but actually you don't really have any reason to feel guilty for it.
Yeah.
At what level, you know?
I think it all feeds into the argument, doesn't it, of once again, crime and punishment, and the idea that actually punishment isn't really the best way to get the result you want. It might be more justice. It's a difficult balancing act. It might be justice for the people you've wronged, but you don't rehabilitate people by punishing them. You rehabilitate them by educating them.
Yeah.
It's like the socio-political satire by Thomas More, Utopia. Have you ever read that?
Nope. Sorry.
to be fair, it's quite obscure. I mean, we're talking sort of the 1500s here.
Oh, right, yeah.
So, but there is a bit in that that's always sort of stuck with me. I'm paraphrasing a bit now. Mm-hmm. But it was talking about the treatment of, obviously, if you stole back then, you could lose a hand for it, or an eye, or you could get nailed to something for a day.
Yeah.
And people could throw fruit at you. That sort of public shaming, or, you know, being maimed like that's really bad, because once someone sees you don't have a hand, then they know you're a thief. So you don't get work, you don't get honest work. And Thomas More's perspective on it, he's awful bugger in a lot of ways, but he had some interesting points. And he was basically saying, if you suffer your people to be ill-educated and their manners corrupted from infancy, and then punish them for those crimes to which their first inclinations dispose them, what else is to be concluded? That you first make thieves and then punish them?
Yeah.
So basically, if you allow a situation to happen and then punish people for the natural results of that situation because they're trying to survive, then what you're doing is creating the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only conclusion is that you created this generation of people who have no other way of surviving and then punish them for it. It's obviously a lot more nuanced and complicated with different things like murder, for example, presumably. Yeah. But it does feed into the idea that punishment actually isn't really an effective deterrent.
No.
And perhaps hell is not an effective deterrent either.
No, I think hell is literally just about our own sense of guilt and our sense of desire for retribution, but not actually desire for... I think hell very much comes from the scape of even if something is resolved, so, oh, we've learned from our lesson, from now on we will put more effort into making sure that people aren't put into a position where they do crime. Someone who's had crime done against them, they're like, yeah, but my father was still murdered, you know, during this breaking and entry. Well, my father was still hit by this drunk driver. I want retribution to that. I want that individual to have to suffer what I do. It comes from that. It comes from our own sense of guilt about things and from our desire to see, for revenge, basically.
Yeah, and it's a natural desire, actually, to want to do that. An old bit of Brehon law for unlawful killing. It didn't really call it murder, it was unlawful killing. Because there was such a thing as lawful killing as well. But what could happen, instead of executing the person who had committed the unlawful killing, their family could have them as a basically an indentured servant until there was something called the Erech, which is the body fine. So it was weregild man gold in Saxon England, whereby you would pay off a certain amount of a person's worth if they were killed. if you killed them in a fight or something. There was no prison. There were no prisons, really. You wouldn't necessarily execute someone for killing somebody else. It was better, in a lot of respects, for them to pay a fine, because that would hit them quite hard. Everybody was sort of in a farming community, so
yeah,
you know, they would feel the pinch that way. There was no public interest in doing it another way. But if somebody couldn't pay, and certainly in Brehon law in Ireland, there was the arraic. If they couldn't pay the arraic, then they could work off their debt in indentured servitude. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it was more valuable to have an unpaid slave, basically,
yeah,
than it was. But on the other hand, there's lots of records of this working out quite well, because the family takes in the person who has murdered the member of their family. And gradually, there's a sort of healing process that happened between the two. Not always. And in some cases, the person who became the body servant was horribly mistreated.
Yeah.
But in other, but it was far less cases than you'd think. And in a way, they were almost getting a replacement for the murdered member of their family. There's an African tribe, which I'm afraid I can't remember the name of, so I'm really sorry. But instead of meting out punishment, when somebody misbehaves badly, and by misbehave, I don't mean sort of like, you know, cocks a snook and sticks the tongue out at somebody because something pretty bad. Instead of casting them out or punishing them, everybody gathers together and they actually, you know, that they sort of, they assume that there's something very wrong in that individual's life for them to act that way. So they embrace them more into the community.
Yeah.
Now, there's got to be some cases where that would be nigh on impossible to do.
Yeah.
But it's a nice thought.
It is a nice thought, and the problem with that is that it only works within small communities.
Yeah, this is not something you could do on a state level or a country level. It really isn't.
And the thing is that, you know, before we get too much into human nature and things like that, there are a lot of ideological things, ways of living, which only work within small communities and can only work within small communities. We talk about on an idealistic level, and we see it happening in practice. But when we see it happening in practice, it's not on a wider scale.
No.
It is on a very small. It is on a much smaller scale, and it's on a scale. It's created not through force, but through a group of individuals who have chosen to live that way.
Yeah, definitely. What's interesting, I suppose, to me, and cards on the table, I'm not advocating this sort of morality whereby, oh, someone murders a member of your family, so take them in. I just find it interesting to talk about, because if someone murdered a member of my family, then, you know, they better find a way off planet.
Yeah.
Ultimately. So yeah. I'm not practicing what I preach, and I'll be perfectly honest about that.
Yeah.
However, I do find the idea that sometimes human justice isn't considered enough. So we've invented the gods. We've got these religious systems in place whereby people are divinely punished.
Yeah.
Because that seems quite peculiar to me. It's almost like we need to take it to the parents.
I like it.
Yeah.
I'm telling on you.
It feels a bit like that.
I think you're right. And I think, yeah, it is about saying that if we ourselves cannot really, you know, perform the crime, but sort of give you punishment, there will be someone higher than us who can, someone who's more powerful than you.
Yeah. And if you think about things like, if you look at Tartarus from Greek mythology in Hades, where, I mean, the gods were the ones who decided on a punishment.
Yeah.
And do you know what Sisyphus, the guy who rolled the stone, obviously, his great crime was?
What?
He tried to trick Hades out of taking him when he died. He tried to trick immortality out of the gods.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, Prometheus did exactly, to warrant being chained up against a rock and having his liver pecked out by an eagle every single day, was to give humans fire.
Yeah, exactly. So really, if you think about it in that respect, the Greek gods hand out what seems to be quite arbitrary and incomprehensible punishments, in the same way that as a child, we might feel that a punishment was unjust when we've done something wrong.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to look at various religions and see the progression of yes, but this fits the crime a bit better, or no, this is very extreme, but that's because we really don't want you to do it, and how it's twisted and tilted the best effect to control populations probably as well.
Yeah. How have you, because when I was sort of coming up with the sort of the hellscape and things like that, particularly for the Sons of Thestian, that I think they mention hell, but they don't really sort of talk about what it is. But there was one little bit of mythos that I created and mentioned, which is the mythos of what happens if you murder someone.
Yeah.
And there's a belief that if you murder someone, you're actually reborn as your own victim.
Oh, right, yeah.
And have to experience their death by your own hand. So basically, if you murder someone, it's actually you killing yourself. So if you've murdered a lot of people, you basically have to live through all of their lives. And you don't remember it while you're living the life, but you remember it just as you're being killed.
Yeah.
And by the end, you know, you presumably by the end, you get to the last victim. And then you've truly understood what all of the victims went through. What the truth of what you did, and that will then sort of decide whether you're cleansed or not. If you sort of walk away with empathy and deep sorrow, you probably are forgiven. If you walk away from it saying, actually, I still made the right decision, you know, I think it's just judged based on that. But I was quite pleased with that. I thought it was a good idea.
No, it's interesting. And not eternal damnation.
Yeah, not eternal damnation. But yeah, hell is the chance for you to learn to for retribution.
Which is a lot more like some of the Eastern religions.
Yeah.
Where hell is basically a transformative state in between.
Yeah.
So for Buddhism, for example, there's samsara. In fact, a lot of the Buddhist perspective is that we are already in hell and we're trying to get out.
Yeah.
That's oversimplifying, but largely that's what it comes down to. Samsara is the place of unquiet ghosts.
I wouldn't be surprised if Earth is hell. Earth is hell. And we're all stuck here until we get out. And the rebirth idea, you know, and reach enlightenment, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the only way I have a slight issue with that is that even with all the terrible things that happen in the world, even with Donald Trump as president, even with things like the Daily Mail existing, Earth is still fantastic.
Yeah, but what if there's a place that's even more fantastic? That we think of this as fantastic, but actually it's nothing in comparison.
I think that's a cross that bridge when you come to it scenario. I think it's a case of you've got to make the best of what you've got right now and go from there, which again, I'm oversimplifying, but you don't really want to go into my philosophizing about potential religious beliefs.
Yeah.
It's a very loose collection. In terms of speculative fiction, I haven't, in the Unveiled series, had a specific hell.
No.
At all. It's very much a state of mind. Characters create it for themselves or not, as the case may be.
Yeah.
And it's far less about punishment or retribution and far more about removing the potential for harm.
Yeah.
And I
did like that because, you know, talking about the first book.
Yeah.
We know of one character who gets sent off, but we don't know what happens to her. All we know is that she's afraid. Really. She's afraid of what's happened, of what comes next. She's afraid of what she will have to face. And her own religious upbringing and her own, attitude is basically what's happened. But they are living in a state of hell already. But she's happy to stay in that state of hell because she's afraid of what comes afterwards. But yeah, there is never any point where Emmeline just says, right, this is eternal damnation for you. I'm going to send you to the fiery plains. You know, that's not a thing that happens. And I always found it quite interesting that characters that you kind of, you know, they're like, no, really, you want them to be punished. never get punished in that kind of way.
No, they don't. I mean, the closest you can probably get is in the second book, when Rhys gets taken away by Evie Gillis, and she says the incomprehensible words, "He might do better on another turn of the wheel," which is in line with her belief system. Her belief system is reincarnation. But that, there's no definite that that's actually what does happen when they cross over.
Yeah.
That's very much a case of you don't really know what happens after the cauldron.
So, yeah.
So yeah, why did I go in that direction? I suppose because, like, rather like you with your, you know, you have to experience what you have caused for other people. It's a case of, I suppose I've got this, ultimately this deep sense that while I personally might want people punished, ultimately it's not an effective way of improving the situation.
No.
And this sense that, you know, we are all, whether we like it or not, connected. And therefore, any diminishment of the individual is a diminishment of the whole.
Yeah.
So, once again, my opinion, my own personal beliefs, everyone's entitled to their own. But no one has ever come to me and said, I don't think so-and-so got punished enough, weirdly, either, so...
No. But then I suppose it's, different. Different ideas. I think we're running out of time.
We have. We've basically just, like, we've philosophized a little bit with this episode.
We did.
But that's okay. We haven't talked about Paradise Lost or any other thing. I mean, obviously, you can put this together with our episodes on Room 101 and the devil and demons and angels and things. You'll probably get a slightly more complete picture.
Yeah.
But yes, we might be visiting hell again on Dissecting Dragons at this rate, because we really have not got through the huge pile of notes.
No, but I think we got some philosophizing down, which which was good.
What's everybody else's viewpoint on hell and punishment, ultimately? Yeah.
Do you believe in hell? Do you not believe in hell? What is hell to you? And do you believe that there are people out there who deserve to burn for all eternity?
And obviously, feel free to say that if you do, but I probably will disagree with you eloquently.
I may not, so I guess we'll see what happens.
We will.
Speak to you guys later. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.